All right, so we got some wild cards open, but the things look like they're buzzing. So grab a line if you can, and we'll get you lined up with David Elkington, Egyptologist and biblical archaeologist working toward the recovery of all of the medal codices. We went through some of the criticisms earlier. Some critics say these can't possibly be real, and they cite some examples of what they think indicate pure forgery. Fair enough. David Elkington says his response to that, and he says it's too early. Still a lot of digging to do and a lot of information to be revealed of what we know so far, which will be coming up in the months ahead. But he'll take your calls and your questions next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. David Elkington is with the metal codices known as the Jordanian codices, these metal books that could go all the way back to the first century. Let's pick up Christopher from North Carolina on the Skype line to get us started this hour on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Christopher?
Shalom, gentlemen. It's great. It's great to be talking with you. I actually went and bought a Coast to Coast subscription today just to hear this program today, as a matter of fact.
Good. Glad to have you. Thank you.
I'm glad to be here. I'm a Messianic Jew, and I wanted to shed some light on some of the things that you guys were discussing here. You know, during this time in history, there was no such thing as Christianity at the time. The followers of the Savior, and we call them Yeshua because of the fact that during the times of Constantine and Constantinople around 316 A.D., the name was changed to Jesus in the Greek and the Latin. The original Gospels and also the epistles of the Apostle Shaul or Paul, they were written in Aramaic at the time.
Christopher, I think we know all. I think we know all these things. So I'm not sure you've been hearing the conversation. What is it that you think we haven't touched on, though, that you wanted to get in?
Well,
what is it?
Well,
what do you think we're missing?
Okay. Basically, what I thought you were missing is I kept hearing the references to the Apostle Shaul going and doing away with the Torah and doing away with the law, and I find that to be very inaccurate when you look back at the original Aramaic text. Now, there's been the argument that it was originally written in Greek, but however, we also must remember that he was also a rabbi.
You're talking about Jesus was a rabbi. Jesus was a rabbi, which we know, right?
I'm talking about the Apostle Paul or the Apostle Shaul.
Okay, I'm not sure that it's uniformly agreed that he was a rabbi, but go ahead. David, did you want to have a thought to what Christopher said there?
I agree with what he said. As I said before the break, Christianity as a term wasn't really coined until 63 AD in the city of Antioch in Syria. But of course, you know, we can only speculate upon which language was used to write the very first Christian writings, because if we look at the figure of Papias, who was Bishop of Hierapolis in around about AD 100, he certainly lived in the first century. He mentions that the original texts of Christianity were called the Oracles of the Lord. Further analysis has revealed that the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all came from a common source, which the Germans have called Q or Keller, meaning source. And we think that that may well have been written in either Greek or in Hebrew rather than Aramaic. And we do know as well from the statements of people like St. Jerome and St. Epiphanius that actually there was a Gospel of the Hebrews, which may well have been a version of the Gospel of Matthew without the Nativity texts, that was also written in Hebrew. What all this goes to show is the uncertainty of Christian origins. I mean, we have a limited amount of information, and discoveries like that of the Jordan Codices may well illustrate further some of those points and help us to understand exactly from where Christianity came and exactly what it was about. But a further point to that as well is that Jesus wasn't just a rabbi. He was actually a king of Israel. And that's something else that Al-Qadisi's talk about. And that's quite something for him and his brother James to share the throne as kings and as high priests of the order of Melchizedek, as the letter to the Hebrews says in the New Testament, is quite something.
Right. And I would dispute this universal, the claim that Paul was a rabbi. I think there's that. Let's just not even go there. But I don't know that that is. I don't believe that's universally agreed to. But let me go to Gail.
No, it's not. I mean, Paul's a very shady character. He says he's a Pharisee, but you know the problem is there's a lot of dispute over that. And if you look at the texts themselves, they all have their opinions about Paul, who is a very controversial character.
Let's just leave it there. West to the Rockies, Gail is in Montana on Coast to Coast for David Elkington and the discovery of these new metal codices, the Jordanian codices. Gail?
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. Pleasure to talk to you.
Good morning, Gail.
Yes, and I really know nothing about you until now, sir, but my one question is, during the life of Jesus and during his brief teaching period, are there any documents that we can prove that were actually put to pen, I mean, you know, that were written and recorded at the time he was talking or very briefly after that?
It's an interesting question. As I've just said, one of the earliest documents we know to have existed because it's attested to by two very early church fathers, one of whom was Papias, the Bishop of Hierapolis, was a document known as the Oracles of the Lord, which is very interesting because it would have been a kind of a list of his statements, rather like the Gospel of Thomas, which is now being accorded very renewed status as potentially the oldest of the Gospels because it doesn't tell a story. It merely gives you a list of Jesus' statements. And that may well have been the case with the Oracles of the Lord. But it's too early to tell yet whether our codices are directly related in that sense, whether they're direct references to what he said. We'll know more in the months to come.
Yeah, I find the Gospels of Thomas, sort of, the Gospel of Thomas, even without the narrative, I find it to be a very interesting book and something which people should read just because it contains the wisdom. And it seems like the things that it would seem like the kind of thing that you would write down first, the things that Jesus said. If you were a Jesus follower, you'd want to remember the wise things he said and you'd write those all down first before you go back and write a biography. You know what I mean? I mean,
exactly.
It just sort of follows logically. Kevin is in Hollywood, first-time caller line on Coast to Coast. Kevin, you're talking with David Elkington.
Okay, hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Kevin. Very good to speak with you.
Yes, and I want you to know that I have in my possession the original long-form birth certificate of Jesus Christ.
Funny joke, Kevin. That's good.
And then I want
like
to show it.
I'd like to see the picture of God in the line that says Father.
Yeah, I'd like to see where it says Father.
Yes, right. Yes, and I hope Donald Trump will show his tax returns, which he doesn't have, probably.
Yeah, that's very funny, Kevin.
I like it.
You had a question, or was it just for the sake of the gag there?
No. I do have a question, and I wanted to ask you, this character, this mythological character, Jesus Christ, Son God, mythological character, did it come about under the Roman, when the Roman Empire ruled at the time? Because I'm in a little bit of a contradiction with the fact that a lot of people say Christianity was there before the Romans ruled, but you know
nobody
the
says
Romans,
that. No, there's no dispute about that. Christianity predated the Romans, right? I mean, nobody says that.
Well, no, excuse me. If I may say, I was under the impression that Jesus Christ, the character of Jesus Christ, was created out of the oppression from the Romans against the Jews, because the Jews, they already had the thing. There was no Christianity and there was no Islam. So when the Romans bowled in, they didn't knock on the door. They just bowled in, right? And they said, you know, Caesar is God, and you're going to pay taxes. And the Jews said, no, screw you. We're not paying you taxes. And they fought him. And it was out of that persecution, right, that this character, this sun god, this new mythological monster.
Yeah. You keep throwing in that myth. I'm trying to follow you here. I think you've got a lot of things all kind of rolled up in there, Kevin, maybe even all balled up together. So you keep saying mythological character. I don't believe it's disputed, maybe within a few fringe people, there isn't any dispute that there was actually a historical Jesus. But even if you don't believe in the divinity of Jesus, and that's fine, but there's no... But anyway, go ahead. David, what would be your response to Kevin?
Well, I agree with you, Ian. I mean, there's too much evidence to suggest that Jesus was mythological. However, there's not enough evidence to suggest who he really was. Our codexes suggest he was a king of Israel, but a king who never reigned. And what it means in that sense is that he was a spiritual king rather than a temporal king. And that's a controversial point. In terms of what he was trying to do, I think he was trying to actually restore elements of the temple worship that had been long lost, including the feminine aspect of God, now known as the Holy Spirit. And that feminine aspect was present inside the temple as the menorah, as the figure of wisdom. And so that's a curious point in itself. As the Greeks once famously said, God without goddess is spiritual insufficiency. And I go along with that. You've got to think here not in terms of who we are today and where we are today, but more about 2,000 years ago with the conditions of the time. And yes, the Jews did rebel against Rome, but let's not forget as well that the temple tax was equally punitive as Roman taxes were at the time. And Jesus was saying that we should rise above all of that. It just didn't matter. His kingdom was not of this world. And that seems to be what the codices are saying.
And we know that historically there had been many claimants to the role of Messiah before Jesus. A lot of people had come and gone before that. So it wasn't that Roman oppression began and suddenly Jesus popped up. There were lots of people that had tried to take that mantle.
Exactly. And what's curious about that is that it was at that stage, around about 50 BC, shortly after the coming of the Roman general Pompey, who then, he invaded Jerusalem, he despoiled the temple, and then, of course, the Romans took over. It's at that time that we end up with the concept of the all-conquering warrior Messiah. Before that, the Messiah was actually the king of Israel. The Messiah was somebody who had been into the temple and faced God and was therefore a son of God by virtue of being king. But there's even a much more ancient version of the Messiah called the suffering servant, who appears in the book of Isaiah, and it talks about how he will be rejected by his people. He will be spat upon. He will then be pierced and killed by the people. It talks about all of those things. And it talks about the man who takes the woes of the world upon himself in order to show the world that it can rise beyond itself and become self-aware. It can become a much more spiritual state. And that's what we have on the codices. We have a portrait of the suffering servant Messiah having taken upon himself the woes of the world. It really is very remarkable stuff.
We will get new images from this when, David?
I'm going to release a couple of these images in about 2 weeks' time. So I'll make sure that one appears on the Coast to Coast website.
Okay. I'm going to make sure you have my email, too, so that I can see them as soon as they become available, because it's just so interesting. Mike is in Livermore, California, on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Go ahead, Mike.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, David. Great show.
Good morning, Mike.
I'm really loving this. As somebody who's coming to Christ at later in life, and this history is just wonderful. Two questions. Do you think that this is going to maybe show some of the early life of Christ that we don't know about? And the second question is, with the way the world is going these days and everybody talking about the end of times and all that, and one of the points in the Bible was that we will not know the end of times until when the end date is, as Ian was talking earlier, May 21st, until we won't know that time until it's exposed to us. Do you think that in these Jordanian these books, will that show? Will that be the enlightenment to tell us when the end times will come? And I'm really curious to hear what David has to say about that, because
let's get a response. Wait no longer. Thank you for the question.
I can tell you straight away, without a doubt, that the end of time is a concept that in physics is one that is merged with the word impossible. But however, I think you've got to look at it this way. God created the universe. You know, the beginning of St. John's Gospel says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. When you go into the Temple of Jerusalem and you go into the presence of God himself, you are going beyond time, because God, in creating the universe, would therefore have created the concept of time. And I think that what it's talking about is that when you become enlightened, when you become full of the Spirit of God, you have gone beyond time into the eternal realm. And I mean, you know, absolutely, eternally, and infinite in that sense. So in a way, by kind of becoming more enlightened, by becoming more at one with who you truly are, and with the idea of what Jesus was saying in the Gospels, you are stepping beyond the end times. The end of time is a curious concept. I mean, what would we expect at the end of time? Everybody says doom and gloom, apocalypse, but the word apocalypse means that which is hidden. And the end of time, that implies something infinite, something where time has stopped. And that's exactly what's described in the Gospels at the nativity of Christ when he comes. The three shepherds witness the sun and the moon and the stars stop in the sky very briefly. It's as if time itself stops. And this, of course, is the role of God. So in that sense, I think the end of time is about personal revelation. And I think if anything's going to happen in the next year or so, it's that people are going to become more personally aware of the divine within themselves and the divine that is out there. And I think at the moment, that would be a very, very good step for humanity, because we really need it at the moment. The world's in a very, very sorry state. It is about time we became less materially minded and more aware of that which is beyond us. I think that's a very critical point. And in answer to your first question, will the codices tell us anything about the early life of Jesus? I can't answer that at the moment, because it's very early in the day. But I'm sure that as time goes on and we actually translate more of these things, there will be things that will tell us about the life of Christ, although in what way, shape, or form, I cannot say. But I wish you all the best.
East of the Rockies, Joshua is in Midland, Texas. We probably have time just for the question, Joshua, but not for the answer. So go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. I got a whole list of questions.
Well, pick your best one here. Go ahead.
Ian, David, y'all are awesome. This show is wow tonight. And I'm basically wanting to, hoping these codices bridge the link between the Romans 4 Paul and the Romans, the Corinthians Paul, the Greek Paul versus the Hebrew Paul. Paul was a Pharisee. Paul was torn between the ordinances of Moses, which were held by the Jews as requisites.
Josh, we're going to run out of time before we get to that question. I know you said you had one.
Basically, where can I send you some money? Because I want to get in on this.
All right. Well, that's a great question. I'm sure David will be happy to answer that one. We'll get to it coming up on Coast to Coast. And coming up tomorrow night, George Norrie will be on too, right? First coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, our computer kind of froze up. So playing the part of a man with a much deeper voice, I'll tell you the numbers on Coast to Coast AM, west of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255, toll free. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 1-818-501-4721. Wildcard line, 818-501-4109. And, of course, there is the Skype line and the international line. And You can find all those numbers at coasttocoastam.com. Just go up to the top of the page under Contact Us. And sorry, we've been having computer problems all night long. Good job, Jesse, holding it together. As we come back with David Elkington on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so let's get to the calls right away, and we'll get as many of them on before the top of the hour that we can for David Elkington on Coast to Coast. We'll start with Will in Madison, Wisconsin on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Will.
Thank you for having me on. This nice guest may have heard of Martin Bernal. Black Athena writes back. If you go to page 122 on that book, there's something rather intriguing. Now, before I say what's so intriguing, let me just say that I was lucky enough as a child to have been born in a Finno-Ugric, Finnish-speaking family in northeastern Minnesota. And I speak it fluently. I've been to England many times. I've been over to Finland, Sweden, Russia. In any event, I want to say something about the words and about what's on page 122 of that book. The Greek language has a very substantial non-Indo-European vocabulary. Yasanoff and Nussbaum agree that a large number of Greek words lack good Indo-European etymologies. Their Indo-European colleague at Oxford, Anna Morpurgo Davies, estimates the proportion of Indo-European words in Greek at less than 40%.
Hey, Will, I got to say, I'm 90 seconds into this call, and I have no idea what you're talking about. I know you have a question in here somewhere.
Yes, yes.
Okay, the question is.
Is it possible that Jesus spoke a Finno-Ugric tongue on the cross? He said, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, Elava, Elava, loime, sabachthin. And to Peter, he said, upon this, kivas.
Are you confusing?
Finno-Ugric, yes.
You're confusing Finnish with Aramaic, right?
Yeah, Finno-Ugric, not necessarily Finnish or Estonian, but some type of Finno-Ugric language with Aramaic mixture.
I can give you a direct answer there. That's not a problem at all. A book you want to read is by Professor I.S. Yehuda, and it is called Hebrew is Greek. Greek and Hebrew share very many similarities. And it may well be that Jesus himself may well have been a Greek speaker, as he was an educated Jew of very high rank in the first century AD. And I think it's well worth a look at. If I can say as well, Ian, in response to your last caller, if anybody is at all interested in being involved in helping us with investment in this project for the excavation, please could they get in touch with me by email at jordancodices@yahoo.com. That's jordancodices@yahoo.com. Thank you.
Scott is in Seattle on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Scott?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hi, Scott. Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, I got a question for you. You said earlier in Hebrews, it says you said that Jesus' brother James was in the order of Melchizedek and being an heir to the throne of Israel. I'm wondering where in Hebrews it says that.
I didn't say that. Jesus is mentioned as being of the order of Melchizedek. James, as far as we know, was accorded the status of high priest, but we don't actually know if he claimed the title of king or not. And I'm looking into that historical enigma at the present time. But Jesus was definitely in the letter to the Hebrews, and there are a few references elsewhere, called a high priest and king of the order of Melchizedek. And that's a very interesting concept indeed. If you want to look further for an answer to that, I can recommend any of the works by Dr. Margaret Barker, and particularly The Great High Priest or The Book of Revelation. These are amazing books by a scholar who has totally transformed the field in the years that she's been involved in it. And they are very highly readable, wonderful books.
And the idea of him being of James's rise would have been based on the idea that he would have been, at least according to some tradition, as being a blood relative of Jesus, that he would be a little brother of Jesus, that he would have risen like any other, like the succession of kings in England, that there would have been a reason that he would have risen to the top while people like Peter and other people were also important, that James held a key role on that basis alone.
He did, right? Indeed, yes. And okay. He was also a member of the Nazarite order as well. We have very explicit descriptions of that too. So obviously, it's a very easy leap to go from James being described as a Nazarite to James being actually described as a leader of the Nazarenes immediately right. after the death of Jesus.
And there we go. First time caller line, Enoch is in Tempe, Arizona, on Coast to Coast for David Elkington.
Hello, Ian. Thank you very much for having me on. I just wanted to make mention here in regards to the topic, because the gentleman that you have has been, or actually the way the topic has been moving is almost as if, there's going to be new revelation, but many of the things that have been spoken, actually there's evidence in the scripture that support.
Enoch, why don't you just talk to David instead of pretending he's not here? So he's talking to you, so go ahead.
No, I'm talking to both of you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
That's okay. You go ahead.
I just wanted to briefly, at the beginning of the conversation, you talked about how the temple was the heart, a living heart of the Jewish people, the yeah. religion, and that's actually supported in the New Testament, and which is interesting because. It was that Jesus was fulfilling the Jewish system, but in death he actually ended it. And the evidence with that is actually found right there in Mark 15:38. As soon as he died, the scriptures points out that the curtain that separated the sanctuary in the temple
right.
tore.
You know why? You know why?
Okay.
Because Jesus himself became the sacrifice. Jesus
Correct.
Did something
Correct.
Very, very remarkable in that he replaced the blood sacrifice of animals with himself. He had himself become the sacrifice. And from the moment that he died and was resurrected, from the moment the veil of the curtain split, at that point onwards, Jesus, who had God inside himself, became a man truly of the people. That's why we celebrate the Eucharist and you know, with the bread and the blood, the body and the blood of Christ.
Right.
It's in all of us, if we choose to do what he did, and that is to sacrifice ourselves with very high spiritual integrity. What he did was a very remarkable thing.
But I think Enoch may have been missing what you said earlier about what the imagery was and why that seemed important in the Jordanian codices. And what you're saying is seeing something that had not necessarily been seen before.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. Particularly the portraits and we've got illustrations here for the first time in history of the interior of the Holy of Holies, the very place where God himself was said to reside. This is very fundamentally phenomenal stuff. And as I say, there was a ban in ancient Israel on the graven image. But I've made the point recently to a friend of mine who said he was rather shocked by this. And I said, well, that's because there was a graven image in the first place. And these books were sealed. They were all sealed all around, and they were placed in caves and hidden away. They were not meant to be seen by everybody. They were not meant to be seen by anybody except those who were in the know, those who were of high priestly or kingly status. So what they're doing is they're preserving the mysteries of the temple for posterity and the mysteries of early Christianity.
Let's go to Kyle in Ohio about the metal codices, which we'll know more of coming up in the weeks and months ahead. But Kyle, you have a question for David Elkington.
First off, I want to say great show tonight, guys.
Thank you.
I read online just recently that actually, Mr. Elkison, you received death threats that made you flee your home and move somewhere else. I was wondering if this was true.
Yeah, that's right. There's been a lot of shenanigans behind all of this, and you know, we've had threats and all sorts of things because you know, we've been trying to get these things repatriated from Israel to Jordan. We believe that they're far too important to disappear into a private collection. We think that as they were found in Jordan, they belong to Jordan, and Jordan wants to do the honorable thing. She wants to put them in a museum for the world to see. And so, of course, you know, there are certain people who would like these things to be sold off into private collections because they could make a lot of money out of it. And it's from them that we've received the death threats, so we've had to be very, very careful.
This is from other collectors who say, hey, back off, let us buy these.
That's right, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a very unscrupulous world out there. But, you know, at the end of the day, we feel that as we got involved in this, we just feel a very strong moral sense of duty that we have to make sure these things are seen by everybody, because if they are what they are, and I've got no reason to believe that they're not, then this could be the one thing that transforms our world into a much better place, and certainly a much safer place and a much more spiritual place.
Jose is in Arizona on a wild card line in our dwindling time for David Elkington with the Jordanian Codices. Jose?
Gentlemen, well, I just also, like the rest of the callers, would like to say great, great show. I have two very quick questions. One is kind of a statement to a caller who called three calls ago. David, would you agree for the gentleman who said he'd like to know more about Jesus' life, that by him reading the Old Testament, understanding that Jesus was very much a Jew and lived a standard Jewish life, that he'd be able to find at least a lot about the instructional life, that the way Jesus grew up?
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. I mean, you have to look at these things in the context of the first century, definitely. But let's not forget that in the first century period in Judea, there were many Judaisms. There wasn't just one form of Judaism. There were many forms, some of it very ancient, some of it new, some of it reformist, much like the Christianities you have today. You know, we talk about Christianity, but then you've got to turn around, well, which Christian? Are you Methodist, Baptist, Catholic, Protestant, and so on and so forth? So, you know, not much change there, I'm afraid to say, in 2,000 years.
Unfortunately, I think I do agree with you. And, you know, I would tell you that as a the second question here, I'll make it brief, gentlemen, is, you know, as I listen, I do find that some of your thoughts are very comparable with mine. I find myself as a Christian being very, very lonely because I am one of the few, I think, who actually embrace and like to recognize that we are ultimately still Jews, being a Christian, that we still follow a Jewish faith and that we're adopted to a Jewish faith if we believe in Jesus. Do you think that these codices will help to unite, from what you've seen of the product, do you think that it'll help to unite and finally put to rest this asinine separation between Christian and Jew, and help us to realize our kind of brother sisterhood in our faith, and then grow to bridge the gaps that right now we exist in, and sometimes unpeacefully with one another? Do you think that these products you're working on will have ability to help with that?
I think definitely. I think that's absolutely a really, really good question, and one that I can answer in the affirmative. Yes, they definitely will help to bring about a new understanding, not only between Christian and Jew, but Christian, Jew, and Muslim as well. Because, you know, we know that the people who wrote these things, a couple of hundred years later, they went off to Mecca, and there is a mention of sealed books in the Quran. But, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of war, a lot of battles fought over the word religion. But let's actually look now at the spiritual aspect of this, which is within the individual, within each one of us separately. If we look at this and let them inspire us and our lives, which we all lead very differently, then the real unity can come about through us understanding who we are and having the courage to be true to ourselves, which means looking in the bathroom mirror, right in your eyes, and saying to yourself, you know, could I do better? And I think you'll find, as I do every morning when I look in my eyes, the answer is always yes.
You know, and I fully endorse that idea. I think there's a strong tradition for a lot of different groups about sealed books. You hear that mentioned, as you said, in Islam, but also I believe, aren't there a discussion of sealed books in Mormonism, right? In Latter Church of the Latter-day Saints? And
indeed,
even
there
And an emphasis in Revelation that someday there would be the discovery of sealed books.
That's right. And I have to say that our friends, the Mormons, are being extremely helpful in the process of repatriation and also in helping us to understand what these things are. And I'm very, very thankful to them.
We have time for one last question. Michael is in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Michael?
Good evening. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I've heard a caller earlier discussing, and you commented on the language Christ may have been familiar with when it came to Greek. And that instantly sparked my interest and caused me to call in, because from what I'm aware, historically speaking, Greek was actually very commonly spoken at that time. And in fact, the Septuagint was the common learning tome for studying Scripture, Old Testament Scripture at the time of Christ. In fact, if you do enough research, you'll find that's what Christ studied, the Septuagint, which I'm sure you're fully aware.
Septuagint.
Okay. Right.
Fine.
Septuagint. That he learned, the information he took in the information.
Quite right, too.
He didn't study the ancient Hebrew and Aramaic. That was what was readily at hand, and it was one of the most
profound. You don't know Aramaic, just so you know, that was more contemporary. So that would have been a language he would have known.
Right.
And also Hebrew,
he didn't
too,
know
because
them?
To be involved in the temple, he would have to have known Hebrew as well.
Yeah.
Well, I understand. But what I'm saying is he most definitely would have been able to, if he could read Greek, he could definitely speak it. And so it's very likely that he would have said, he could have very easily have spoken things, whether it would be on the cross or elsewhere, that would have, in fact, been Greek, not necessarily specifically Hebrew.
No, quite right.
Entirely possible. The problem is we just don't have any proof of that. I mean, it's not it's a perfectly logical point to make, but we know that part of the empire used Greek as the official language of the oppressor, and that people would have spoken it commonly, but we don't necessarily have any evidence that Jesus spoke Greek. We know that Paul did, but not necessarily Jesus, although it's a logical assumption to make, right?
It definitely is a logical assumption, but as you say, you're quite right. There is no proof of that. But again, we have to look in the context of the Temple of Jerusalem itself and the context of who Jesus was and what he represented. It's very likely he had at least a good knowledge of Greek. He definitely would have spoken Aramaic, and he would definitely have had a knowledge of Hebrew. So he would have been trilingual, I suppose.
Right.
And also, in getting to know certain of the characters involved in the temple, the high priest, as well as some of the Romans, even, that he was approached by a centurion to heal his servant. He may well have been a very good Greek speaker.
And that's just where we'll have to leave it, waiting for more revelations to come out of the metal codices known as the Jordanian codices. We will continue to follow the story. We look forward to your revelations as they become available to us. We will continue to share them over the weeks and months ahead. And thank you, David, for being so generous with your time tonight and bringing us up to speed. And from this point forward, we'll just have to wait to see what's on those metal pages and the images and the words as they get interpreted. And hopefully some people will step forward with some funding for you, too. You can find out more about that by going to our website. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.